this, like, the season opener, did it make you cry? I've heard it's like a crier.
I mean, I'm sure it made somebody cry, yeah.
You're such a fucking serial killer.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again, co-host Keith Foster, San Diego.
And with me is the host, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles.
And today we're going to be talking about The Incredibles 2. And at the end of the program, for our Netflix homework, we're going to review an infamous cult film, Battlefield Earth, which neither of us had ever seen before.
A cult film, I think, produced by a cult.
Yeah. That does kind of distinguish it a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think that makes it unique in the cult film canon.
For sure. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's go ahead and get into our first segment. We haven't done this one for a while.
For a little bit.
Let's go ahead and get into obey, consume. What have we been watching? What have we been listening, reading, eating? I don't know.
I did think one. This one gives us at least something to talk about.
Sure.
Kanye West.
Okay.
He released his controversy. You know, he's known for his controversy. Mm-hmm. And it led up to the release of his I don't even know if you can really call it an album. I think it's more of an EP.
Seven songs, right?
Yeah. And then he released, like, the next week or something, mm-hmm. he released a joint thing that he did with Kid Cudi.
Right.
And Kid Cudi also, I think, appeared on one of the songs on his, like, solo album.
He did. That is true.
Yeah. Been busy.
Pretty busy. Yeah.
So I was
on top of all of the shenanigans.
Yeah. Okay. Just a quick note on that. I don't endorse what Kanye West says. Mm-hmm. I think he is intentionally inflammatory and kind of an idiot when it comes to stuff he says. Mm-hmm. But I've also I also sort of am a little like, okay, are we really upset at Kanye for saying controversial shit? Like, that's sort of his brand.
Sure.
So, I don't know. To me, I was like, I take it all with a grain of salt. Like, I don't know. I thought it was weird how upset people got. I don't agree with what he said, but whatever. Anyway. Yeah, so I listened to his solo album because I'm a Yeezus fan, musically, not politically. And so his newest album, I was pretty disappointed by it. I was kind of his last one too, Life of Pablo. I was like, eh, like I really was feeling like he peaked at the album Yeezus.
Even that one's sort of controversial, isn't it? Like, I'm not really a Kanye West fan. Like, I only know of him by osmosis of him being as popular as he is. You just have to know about who he is.
Yeah.
But I remember when Yeezus came out, people were like, this is weird. And then...
it is weird, but it's I think it's great. Between that and My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy are both, I think, incredible albums. But anyway, so I was like, okay, this is definitely lesser yay. and then the Kid Cudi album came out, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a fan of Kid Cudi as well. So I was like, when I heard they were releasing a duo thing, I was like, oh, that's fucking cool. But it, my problem with it, that one, is it's way too short. It's only 7 songs as well.
Right. So then, actually, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I work in an office setting now, so it's no like customers to deal with. So we have Spotify going generally all day. And, you know, a lot of the people I sit around, they listen to lots of different kinds of music. And so I've pretty much heard the entire new Kanye West record just, again, by osmosis of the person next to me playing it. And he was talking about how short the album was. And we got into a conversation about how, like, with every format change, it affects the length of the album. So, like... when it was just vinyl and you could only fit about 4 songs per side, an eight to 10 song album was pretty much the standard. And then when CD came out, you could fit up to 18 to 25 tracks. And so all of a sudden, albums got longer and longer and longer. And then, you know, peaked around the time of like 2005 when everybody was releasing double albums.
Yeah. And it was like 40 tracks, and I'm just
it was a problem,
and some and a lot of them could have been like B-side material.
Most of it.
So normally,
and then with the change to digital, now we're seeing like the dissolve of the album as a concept. And people, like, I know Weird Al, he announced that his last album, Mandatory Fun, would be his last album. And from now on, if he wants to record something, he's just going to record it and release it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what a lot of people, like, a lot of people just release singles or tracks now.
Yeah. And I think short albums, like, or just a collection of songs or mixtapes, whatever you want to call it, is going to be the norm.
And I am a fan of economical albums. So like, honestly, when he said it was going to be 7 tracks, I was like, oh, that's sort of perfect, because usually that's about all I listen to. But they're also short songs. Like, some of them clock in under 2 minutes.
Yeah. It's not like he has a 14 minute epic somewhere in there.
So what I did was I remixed it with the Kid Cudi album. And it's a fucking banger now. I honestly feel like they were meant to be one album.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of like hullabaloo around the release of the last album about how like he went back and changed a bunch of lyrics because of the controversy and like that, and like re-recorded like stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, there's one song that addresses the controversy, but I mean, for the most part, he doesn't really talk about it. I mean, he does it on a couple of tracks, but I don't know. Again, that's him. That's what you're signing up for. So, you know, is it problematic in 2018 when everybody's very sensitive and on eggshells about everything? Yeah, I mean, I get that. You know, if people want to be upset by the dumb shit he says, I'm not going to fault them for that. But to me, it's like, I don't know. It's not like it's new.
No, it isn't.
It's weird to me that people could be on board for him and his personality until now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that, because you're talking about...
There is.
You're talking about a lot of stuff. There's bigger implications than just him chewing out Taylor Swift. But...
Yeah. That's true.
And he's a very influential, like, popular person, so his opinions do have some sort of sway. So I get it. I personally don't care, because I personally don't care about Kanye West, generally speaking. I think
an equally valid response. I think the world would be a better place if less people did care about what he said.
But yeah, and you know, cult of personality and all that stuff. So anyway,
yeah, I get it. This is just a roundabout way of me justifying still listening to it.
You do what you have to do. Okay, I have dipped back into season 2 of Queer Eye on Netflix.
I've heard just things.
Yeah, they just posted a new season. It's really good. It's a I've lot.
The season opener, did it make you cry? I've heard it's like a crier.
I mean, I'm sure it made somebody cry. Yeah.
You're such a fucking serial killer.
No, I mean, I get the feels. But I think I said this the last time I talked about this, not even very long ago. But you can feel the formula and the way they write the episodes. And you know, like, oh, here's them, when their subjects are, like, going into their backstory and they play the music. And, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's a little hard for me to separate, like, the scriptedness of it with the reality of how sad it is. I still enjoy the show a great deal. And I think that, and I do believe those stories. It's not like they're crisis actors. I believe that these people actually went through the stuff they went through. In fact, the last episode I watched, they are helping a trans person after he just transitioned. And he's trying to kind of get his bearings. And, you know, it's so when there's like picking up clothes for him and stuff like that, it's more than just like, we want to make you look better. It's like, we want you, they're like essentially assisting him in this transition. So it's pretty heavy.
We want to help you be a fashionable man.
Yeah. Well, not even just that, but like, here's clothes that are going to make you comfortable. Here's clothes that are going to emphasize your shoulders, things like that.
Yeah, that's true because that's interesting.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And obviously, something they wouldn't have been able to do in the early 2000s version of it when they only had one day with their subject. So that's really good. I've been into that. I only have a few episodes left of that. And then on the audio side of things, I've been super into this podcast that I discovered through Reddit, I think, called Axe to Grind. And it is a podcast by a bunch of old, and by old, I mean they're like our age or a little bit older, hardcore dudes who used to tour in bands and stuff like that and run record labels. And then just kind of going over, you know, the state of the scene as it stands today, who's new, who's hot, who's coming back, what are the tours. They do interviews every once in a while with active bands. And a lot of talk about like old versus new, and a lot of talk about intergenerational hardcore and like what does it mean in 2018 versus what it meant in 1998. So that's been pretty entertaining.
All right.
And they're also really funny, cool dudes who speak very frankly.
What's this called again?
Axe to Grind.
Axe to Grind. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Very East Coast. Like if you're a fan of, you know, hardcore music or punk music in general, you get a whiff very fast that their perspectives are distinctly East Coast biased.
Sure.
But that's fine. That's the way it works. Do you want to just go ahead and get into our survey?
Yeah. Let's do it. We've been doing these surveys lately, and I think they're a lot of fun.
People like the surveys. And I always say at the beginning of this, if you want to see the surveys we post, I usually post them around Fridays to get some good responses or get a good amount of responses. This one was, what is your favorite Pixar movie? Sub question, what is your favorite Pixar sequel? Not everybody answered both parts, but you said you had some on your side. Why don't you go ahead and go through
yours? Yeah, so I shared the link on my Facebook page as well, so I got a few responses on my Facebook page.
Yeah, sure. I guess I can go through the official page first. And if you want to see the surveys when they go up, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, or you can follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. Sometimes I post them there. The first response is from Brad Page, who we used to go to high school with. His favorite is WALL-E. And his favorite
sequel. I'll do that every time.
And his favorite sequel is Toy Story 3. And then Ashley Hitchcock. It throws me off. She has a different name on Facebook, but
I don't think you're supposed to say that. She's doing it to stay anonymous, right?
I don't know. It's because of things, but she's been on the podcast where we used her real name, so I think we're good.
That's true.
She speaks for her boyfriend, who we also know. Cade's favorite is The Incredibles, the first Incredibles. And then she says, this is so hard for me, but I might have to say Toy Story, the original, because I grew up watching it and that nostalgia be strong. But I super duper love WALL-E. And then she says Coco and Inside Out get honorable mentions. Her favorite sequel is either Monsters University or Toy Story 2. Toya Davis.
I'll read a couple. We can switch off. We can do like a back and forth thing.
Okay, go ahead.
So Thomas Sievers says the one where their employees' wages aren't fixed. And then he says also WALL-E. Being a bit of a grump there.
Yeah, well, there's things about Disney right now, but I think it's not so much the animators who are getting us super screwed. They're probably getting a little screwed, but it's the people who work in the park who have to sleep in their car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's upsetting, but we're not getting into that.
Any others? You want to read a couple more?
Sure, yeah. Bo Dorian, DJ Mancat, if you've seen him around town, he says Toy Story, any of them, is number one. Number two, he puts Catwoman, so bit of a jackhole answer there.
Yeah.
Troll. He puts eight lives, so again, a jackhole answer. Mm-hmm. And then he puts Up and WALL-E.
Okay, yeah. And then the real answers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Leland Brungart. Oh, I forgot to read Toya's. Toya Davis, says her favorite is Monsters Incorporated, followed closely by Up, both for their emotional factors. That's a big deal in Pixar movies usually.
Mm-hmm.
Leland Brungart, who's been on the show before, I originally ripped off his podcast, The Nitpick It, back in 2009.
You're not supposed to admit
that. Oh, I told him that on our show. It's okay. We're good. But his favorite is Ratatouille. He says the speech by Peter O'Toole at the end is wonderful. And his favorite sequel is Toy Story 2. Okay. Do you have any more?
Yeah, I got a couple more. Marissa Carter says a toss-up between Toy Story, Cars, and Finding Nemo. As for sequel, favorite, maybe Dory. We didn't like Toy Story 2 and or 3. Our kids couldn't watch the conveyor belt scene. Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
And Cars 2 was blah. And then Tracy Kaufman says, number one, WALL-E. Number two, Finding Nemo. And number three, Bug's Life. Oh, that's the first
Bug's Life. Underrated, I think, a little. Chris Fowler says Monsters Incorporated. He says Hillary doesn't care. I have a hard time believing that.
Hillary.
A hard time believing that.
Yeah.
Trisha Hull.
You got a friend, did me.
Trisha Hull says her favorite is Up, and her husband Chris, who I used to do Video Clerks with on YouTube, says Monsters Incorporated. A sequel for both of them is Toy Story 3. Ashley Lawrence, your significant other, says it's a three-way tie between The Incredibles, WALL-E, and Inside Out. I think this is the first vote for Inside Out.
I think somebody, Ashley mentioned it as an honorable mention.
You're correct.
That and Coco. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Still haven't seen Coco. It's on Netflix now.
Oh, you should watch it. It's good.
Do you have any more?
No, that's all for
me. That's all for your list? Okay. Chantel says her favorites are Up and Ratatouille as a tie, and then Coco as a close second, Finding Dory being her favorite sequel. Todd Flatland says Up is the correct answer. And it's a very Todd answer. And then Diana Falcon says she loves Ratatouille, and Toy Story is a blessing.
Toy Story 2 is a blessing.
Toy Story 2 is a blessing. So that being her favorite sequel, I suppose. Very interesting. I think it's interesting that there's so many votes for Toy Story 2 because clearly Toy Story 3 is the better sequel.
Okay.
Maybe more people saw Toy Story 2.
I think they
don't remember which plot is which.
It's probably a lot because Toy Story 3 is so dark at the end. I think that turns a lot of people off.
I mean, it's there's some dark stuff in it generally, but I wouldn't say there's anything more dark in that than there is in other Pixar movies.
It's, I mean, you think all the characters are gonna like die, all of them for a minute. It's pretty like,
there is a moment where they all accept death. Yes, that happens.
Yeah. So I think that's probably why Toy Story 2 is probably a bit more popular, because that's the one where they introduce Jesse.
Right.
And it doesn't have the heaviness that Toy Story 3 has. I have only seen Toy Story 3 the one time.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I liked it, but both the Toy Story sequels just fail to live up to the original to me.
I disagree, but I mean, I like the first one a lot, and I think the first one is still a top three Pixar movie for me. It's just as far as being original and game changing, you know, when it comes to animation, great voice talent,
it's a great story,
and great concept,
great characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Introduced the, you know, brand new characters and launch Pixar in a big way. So yeah, I'm all about Toy Story. I think Toy Story 2 is for me the most forgettable of the three. There's some fun stuff in it, and I like the villain and whatever, but to me, I think Toy Story 3, and maybe it's because I went into it not expecting very much, and I thought that it was kind of a superfluous idea to even do one. But then it kind of blew me away and like was actually really good.
I need to watch it again, because I remember wanting to be blown away by it, but I wasn't.
Maybe watch them all together.
I liked it.
Do a Toy Story marathon. Get the whole saga.
I know. My wife isn't a huge fan of the Toy Story movies, but I think the first one...
It's the most fun of the three,
The first one is like... I kind of think it might be Pixar's best movie. Like, I don't know if they've ever been able to top it.
It's best or your favorite? Because that's the question. And now, of course, going into this, we're going to not... Yeah. We're not going to regard Incredibles 2. We're going to pretend that we haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
What's your favorite Pixar movie?
So, favorite is probably between Toy Story and Incredibles. I did recently rewatch The Incredibles to get like psyched for Incredibles 2.
Sure.
And I just forgot how much I fucking love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's between those two.
Yeah, I think probably me too. I hate to be that guy who disagrees with you on that, but, I know for a fact those are the ones I've watched the most. I think there are some movies that are maybe a little bit more like artistic or whatever.
Sure.
I think WALL-E is probably a slightly more ambitious film than either of those.
I love WALL-E. And I really liked I loved Inside Out.
Inside Out is really good. Inside Out's pretty competitive, actually. I mean, I haven't lived with it long enough to have it. I have a really cemented opinion, other than I know I loved it. But as far as like weighing it against the others, like I don't have that kind of like lifelong connection to it that I do with some of these others.
I do also think that Inside Out was a sort of a watershed moment for their animation. I think that was like a big.
You think so? Even more so than like finding Nemo and stuff, because like that, like, you know, the stuff, the oceanography and the water.
Sure,
and all that stuff.
I think all of that is great, but I really think Inside Out sort of kicked it to the next level. If that makes sense.
All right.
Like,
I thought it was pretty decidedly more stylized and cartoony in a direction than they had gone previous.
But like the animation and just like the textures within, I just think there's a lot more, like the characters have a lot more going on than some of their older stuff, which is a little flatter.
You know what we don't see in any of these answers? Cars or Brave?
Isn't Brave Disney?
No, Brave was a Pixar.
Was it?
Yeah.
I thought it was
it was kind of it like predated when Disney started doing princess movies again. And I think a lot of people kind of lump that in with like the Tangled Frozen kind of world, but mm-hmm. it was a technically a Pixar movie.
Oh, all right. I liked Brave. I'm a Brave apologist. I think Brave is actually kind of underrated. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's as ambitious as any as a lot of their other stuff, but I've never seen Cars.
I haven't seen any of the Cars movies, and I probably should, or Planes. I probably should just to like have an opinion about
Planes
it.
Planes is Disney.
Yeah, that was like done. Like, I think actually that was supposed to be a direct to DVD, and then they were just like, ah, fuck it, let's release it.
Well, I think the second one was definitely supposed to be a direct to DVD. yeah, you don't see a lot for Cars, and Cars mm-hmm. 2, the weird spy one that everyone forgot about.
Was that 2 or 3?
That was 2. We just watched a trailer for when we rewatched The Incredibles.
And
we
what
the fuck is this? I think you see a lot of the same answers. Up, I think the problem with Up is that sort of the rest of the movie can't live up to
the first 10 minutes.
10 minutes, which is
there's like good stuff along the way, but it's all anchored on that first 10 minutes. Like that is what that is what's literally holding the movie together. Mm-hmm. I think if it were just a movie about a kid and an old man and talking dogs and a weird bird, like it would be fine. But yeah. I don't think it would be as memorable as the fact that the movie just guts you emotionally.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so, yeah.
But as a plot goes, it's kind of weird and almost making itself up as it goes.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of fun, and I think some of that playfulness gets carried over, and some of those themes I think get carried over to Up or to Inside Out.
Yeah, same director.
Are maybe a little more effective as a through line.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Up.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with Up. It's just it's a very kind of crazy weird movie. Like like I said, it kind of feels like it's making itself up as it goes, but I do enjoy that movie a lot. I'm not going to call it my favorite or even like great, but if I were doing like a most underrated, I think Bug's Life is a hoot. I think Toy Story was an impossible act to follow. Yeah. And, there was the unfortunate, parallel release with Ants that year.
I think that more than anything is sort of what, my mind as a, you know, a child.
Yeah.
I had a hard time distinguishing them. And the one with Woody Allen, I was like, oh, that one makes me feel icky. And so by association, the Bug's Life also kind of made me feel icky, even though it there's no reason for it.
No. But if you watch it, it's a hell of a lot of fun. And it's pretty much it's Seven Samurai with bugs.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. That. I need to rewatch that. To me, I think lesser ones are like Monsters, Inc. I was super crazy about.
But there's a big, fiery cult of Monsters, Inc. fans. And when I tell them, like, I don't want to watch movies about fucking toddlers, like, they look at me with death eyes.
Also, I need to see Ratatouille again, but I did really like that one a lot.
Yeah, that's good. Plot issues with Ratatouille, not even plot, but like plot mechanic issues. Like there's some weird like board game rules in that movie, like the whole like pulling of the hair controls the man's arms. We're already a bridge pretty far with talking rats, and then you're adding this.
To me, I actually found Coco, like I liked Coco about the same as I liked Ratatouille, if that makes sense.
In the middle.
Yeah, they were charming in a lot of the same ways, I thought. So, but I mean, again, I think the beautiful thing about Pixar is like there's definitely like a story in their canon for sort of everybody.
Sure.
And they're so good at telling, you know, even Pixar's worst, I would hold up against like any fucking DreamWorks shit, you know?
Yeah.
They're just so good at telling human emotional stories. Yeah. with fun and beautiful animation, and Pixar is just great.
They're great. Well, Pixar, in my mind, is what is like the real legacy of like the traditional Disney film.
Yeah.
Right. So I know, and Disney has their own animation studio now. It's putting out like Moana and Big Hero 6 and all of these movies that are, you know, perfectly fine. Although, sidebar, did you see that trailer for Wreck-It Ralph 2? Because Bomb City.
Yeah.
That really looks like the.
I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt. Because I liked Wreck-It Ralph, but it does kind of look like the Emoji Movie.
Yeah, it's the Emoji Movie for Disney and Silicon Valley to jerk itself off. Anyway,
I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt, but I was not impressed by the trailer.
That was a rough trailer. But yeah, I think that, you know, Pixar in general, even though John Lasseter like went over and is doing his own stuff with Disney Animation now, and being fairly competitive as far as that goes, I think that the Pixar legacy sort of picks up where the classic Disney like family movie.
Oh, what about the fucking Good Dinosaur?
That's a movie fucking nobody saw.
Did anyone see it?
I don't think so. Nobody I know personally. Yeah. I'm sure somewhere saw it, but
I feel I don't know. I feel
that's
like
the underdog of the
yeah.
Yeah. If that ever pops up on Netflix, we definitely got to make that homework.
Yeah, we do. All right.
Okay, well, that's a good lead up right into Incredibles 2. And why don't you go ahead and set that up? What happens in The Incredibles 2?
All right. So The Incredibles 2 picks up right after the events of The Incredibles 1. Like, mm-hmm. Literally, it starts where that ends.
Yeah.
They take on the Underminer as he's robbing a bank. There's some collateral damage. The Incredibles get in trouble because superheroes are still illegal in the mm-hmm. world of the Incredibles. There's a concerned billionaire philanthropist who sees the action, and he is all about getting superheroes legalized again.
Mm-hmm.
So his solution is to meet with Mr. and Mrs. Incredible and Frozone and propose to them the idea of body camming the superheroes,
mm-hmm.
Specifically Elastigirl, because she has a better track record with collateral damage
mm-hmm.
than the other two heroes, leaving Mr. Incredible to stay home this adventure and take care of the family. And that's the basic setup. And then Elastigirl, Mrs. Incredible, she encounters a supervillain who has, you know, nefarious intent. And does the Incredibles family have to come and help out? Probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And along the way, we meet a lot of the same characters that we met in the first one and a lot of new ones as well.
Yeah, a lot of new superheroes who were joining the fight to sort of get re-legalized.
Yeah. So how do we want to tackle this review? Do we want to talk about movie stuff, story stuff, or do we want to talk about technical stuff first? Or do we want to frame this in the how long we've waited for this sequel? You know what? I think I'm going to start there. I think one thing we have to think about when we're thinking about The Incredibles is The Incredibles 1 came out in what, 2003?
2004. It's been 14 years.
So since The Incredibles came out, and I think one of the reasons why you and me in particular and a certain fan base really responded to The Incredibles as being like their favorite Pixar movie is because not only was it a great Pixar movie, but it was a fucking great superhero movie.
And yeah, in a time when There weren't that many. As many great superhero movies.
Yeah, no, the superhero thing was just getting off the ground. We had a few Spider-Man movies at that point. We had a few X-Men movies. Yeah. And certainly the popularity of those movies is probably what set the Brad Bird off on doing The Incredibles.
The Incredibles was... The first Incredibles was the Fantastic Four movie we never got.
Right, yeah. It was better at being the Fantastic Four than that original movie was. And that's the thing that happened is, like, after Spider-Man and whatever, there were a lot of these kind of, dead on arrival attempts at sort of cashing in on the superhero model.
Superhero craze.
Yeah, but so it didn't really happen. It didn't really, there wasn't a formula really set in stone until really 2008 with the arrival of both Iron Man and The Dark Knight. And both of those movies, I think, kind of set two different templates for how to make a successful superhero movie. Yeah. And certainly the Marvel model, like, Marvel is pretty much the only movies people go to now. And Logan or whatever would be sort of more in the model of The Dark Knight. But so I think
we're talking about The Incredibles in context to
the superhero
movies. Yeah. In regards to this one, I was very conscious that superhero movies are very different now than they were when the first one came out. So I was,
and that culture at large sees them differently than we did then, because now it's something that people can take for granted. Whereas in 2004, there was still sort of a novelty to it.
Yes. So I was very much trying to not compare it to, I was only trying to view it from the viewpoint of, how does this pair with the first Incredibles movie?
Yeah,
I was really trying to ignore sort of the greater superhero context, and I do think that there are things in this movie that
In conversation with that context.
Yeah, so the first Incredibles was sort of a postmodern take on superheroes, because there were a lot more sort of cliches to play with. One of my favorite things is when Mr. Incredible tricks Syndrome into monologuing.
For sure. Yeah, that's great.
And there's a lot of things like that that are sort of commenting on
playing the tropes genre. Yeah.
And Incredibles 2 sort of doesn't. It sort of plays into them a little bit more. It's a little less nod and wink, and a little more just trying to play it as straight as possible as far as superhero stuff goes. It doesn't mean there isn't still humor to be had and stuff, but they aren't challenging superhero conventions as much in Incredibles 2.
For sure.
Which I don't know. I did kind of miss that element from the first one.
The slight satirical.
Yeah, just the sort of like, we're doing this, but we're also poking holes in it at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I think that can also be attributed to the way Pixar movies have changed. Because if you look at like Toy Story, there's a lot of that kind of humor there too. And at the time, Toy Story was still very much the model that most Pixar movies were going for. So Toy Story plays with the idea of toy tropes and television tropes.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I did miss that a little bit, but it didn't like kill the movie for me. I'm just going to say, just to get it out of the way, I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a lot of fun. I really liked seeing this family of characters in action. Like, I've really come to care about these characters and this family. And so it was nice to get a second adventure with them.
For sure.
I'm not trying to be, I don't know. I was very much trying not to judge it on like the, we've been waiting 14 years for this, because I think that's putting too much pressure on it. I was just trying to view it as like their next adventure, and I feel like it delivers in that context. So it was really fun to see, you know, like Elastigirl be the one in charge this time, to see her adventures versus Mr. Incredible's adventures. That being said, you know, I don't think it's as solid as the first one. I don't think the plot isn't as sort of bulletproof. Pun very much intended. Thank you. I do think if you're looking at just the story of this one, it's a little all over the map. To me, the strongest thread is Mr. Incredible at home.
Interesting. Okay.
I feel like the criminal element is
the genre stuff.
I liked it. Yeah, I liked it, but it is very, you know, like that could have been a plot to a Batman animated series episode.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And but done without any irony.
Yes, exactly. So, and I think that maybe that's why that chunk of the movie didn't feel as fresh as maybe the first one did. But I still really enjoyed it because I love living in that world of like the Batman animated series and stuff. Sure. Like that.
Well, I think this movie, technically speaking, it is the same world, and it does pick up literally minutes after the last story ended, but you can see the jump in the animation. And I think there is an influence of sort of the Marvel thing on the way that set pieces are dealt with in this movie. There's a lot more of them. They're longer. Yeah. They're kind of more multi-segmented. I imagine this movie was made for 3D as well. So there is some of like throwing stuff at your face kind of thing. And, you know, putting you on trains and like going really fast through the screen and that kind of stuff. But yeah, like the animation in this movie is really fantastic. The action scenes are like genuinely really well thought out and really fun to watch. Brad Bird knows how to do a set piece.
I mean, I will say that I felt the same about the first one as far as that goes. Like I remember seeing the first one and being like surprised at how good the action was for this, you know, animated family cartoon.
Yeah, it's not something we really expected when we saw
it. Yeah, so I was kind of expecting it in this one, and it definitely delivers.
But even still, there was some stuff. And also, I think it explores the world of The Incredibles more than the last one. There's not as many locations in the first movie. We see primarily like a jungle setting, a suburban setting, and a little bit of city. But in this one, we get to see a lot of city, and we get to see how they really play with the art direction of this kind of like late 60s sort of Mad Men-ish looking world.
Sci-fi.
Yeah.
Like alternate history sort of.
Right. Exactly. This kind of pulp comic booky sort of Will Eisner sort of look.
I thought there were really fun, Easter eggs to sort of nod to his influences too. Like when the dad is trying to watch Outer Limits, one day Dash is watching Johnny Quest.
Sure.
Which is obviously a huge influence on this world.
You know what? If they ever decide to do a for real Johnny Quest movie, Brad Bird should definitely be the guy who does it.
Oh, 100%. Or I would also accept Doc Hammer and Jackson Publick, who do the Venture Brothers.
That might be a little too on the nose.
I don't know. Either way. And that's another thing, too, because when did the Venture Brothers start?
Venture Brothers started around 2005 or so.
Yeah. And that's very postmodern.
That's like the most postmodern.
Yeah. And it's much more adult than The Incredibles.
Right.
But
it's not like that. That sort of perspective of the superhero thing or the comic book thing has never been done before. The first Incredibles
back to like The Tick
from definitely, I think, is like so influential on this whole thing that nobody talks about it. Maybe they do now because of that new show. But and also like stuff like Freakazoid was happening when we were kids. So this kind of like look at like superhero. I mean, you could even go as far back as The Greatest American Hero.
Okay. Yeah, I can. All right.
And
yeah,
basic.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
Basically, a lot of the plot of or a lot of the kind of world building of The Incredibles is kind of founded in Alan Moore-ish Watchmen-y stuff.
Well, so that's another thing I want to talk about. So like the first one has sort of like this Watchmen element of like these superheroes are getting taken to this island and they're getting killed off. You know, and there's sort of this mysterious presence at work.
Yeah.
Whereas this one doesn't have that sort of mystery element.
There is a mystery here, and I would
a little bit.
I would say that the movie almost hinges too much on this mystery because it's unless you're under 10 years old, it is incredibly easy to solve.
Yes. I agree, and maybe that's why it seems less prevalent, but so this one, if Incredibles 1 is Brad Bird's version of Watchmen, which I think you can make, I don't think that's a crazy leap to take.
I'm sure that was an influence, yes.
Yeah, I would say that this is sort of, you know, there's elements of like Marvel's Civil War with this, where like the idea of the legality of superheroes, and it's also, you know, incredibly relevant to the times.
Here's my issues with Incredibles 2. First of all, I'll just say I liked it. I had fun with it. Here comes the grump. I like the action a lot. I like the animation a lot. I like these characters still. I like the voice talent. There's enough there in the components to keep me engaged. As a story, I think it's a pretty big letdown, and I think thematically, it's not as sound as the first one. It's not as scaled down. They bring up a lot of ideas. They're like, hey, body cams, that's a thing that's happening now. That doesn't really go anywhere.
I definitely agree with you there. Like, the first one, I think a big strength of the first one is there's this huge theme of adultery. And sort of how you can destroy a family with good intentions kind of thing. And I do feel like thematically this one isn't as strong.
Well, I think one of the major themes of the first movie, and that maybe that manifests in sort of an adultery metaphor, is generally speaking, masculinity. And post-war masculinity. And I think he actually is talking about sort of that 50s, 60s American suburban guy who just got back from World War II and doesn't quite know what to do with himself anymore. And he, you know, he was saving the country one minute and now he's stuck behind a desk. And, you know, so I think that Brad Bird actually is smart, like really smartly playing into those classic American themes. And this one, he kind of flips it a little bit by making, you know, this almost kind of like extending it from like the 50s post-war masculine issue to sort of the 60s, where now the woman is out working and the man is stuck at home. And so,
and I think
that's super stuff, interesting, but it
I
also
think that's the stuff that works the best in this as well.
Yeah, when they decide to do that. But I think the problem is, again, like the body cam thing, it's suggested and then not really followed through. You have, you know, a lot of scenes where he's at home and he's like, you know, flustered trying to like deal with the daughter who's like has boy issues, and the son who can't learn math, and then the baby who keeps changing into creatures.
Oh my god! When the baby fights the raccoon, though,
I think that scene is almost indicative of the problem of the movie. It's like
Okay, I'm done listening to you. You're wrong. That scene is so much fun.
It's fun, but it's an aside, and it's just for cute baby stuff. It's not
for cute baby stuff. It's for, you know, how Bob is dealing with the challenges of actually showing up and actually being a parent.
Right.
Because he hasn't had to be before. So it's not just cute stuff. It's a really fun, cute action sequence that is directly challenging the preconceived notions of the main character.
If you want to make that argument.
I do.
I think it's to sell Jack-Jack toys. I think that's
Fuck
what that
you.
Sequence is for.
And
some of the stuff at the end with the baby, too. I think a little bit of Jack-Jack goes a long way. And there's a lot of that in this movie.
But my only real complaint with Jack-Jack is I thought that story was going to somehow tie into the overall climax. Like,
sure.
It did bother me that it was just sort of like, oh, he has powers, you know, like I thought it would be mm-hmm. at the end, like they would have to somehow use Jack-Jack powers to save the day. I thought that's where that was going.
I think they do a little bit, don't they? I mean,
a little, like there's a little, but I thought it was going to be much more significant. Like I thought it was going to be literally Jack-Jack saves the day. And I think that should have happened because that is my biggest complaint about Incredibles 2 is just I do think there's a lot going on. And then some of it gets kind of forgotten by the third act for the big action set piece.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to see some of these things tie together a little more nicely.
I mean, I felt like a lot of it was really telegraphed, though. Like, I mean, to the point where when they introduce certain characters, I'm like, oh, they're the villains. Like, of course, obviously, they're the villains. And yeah. then it was so obvious that I'm like, this has to be a red herring. Like, it's there's no way it's just going to. And then it was just, I was like, oh, well, okay, nah, never mind. There's another scene where Elastigirl meets a bunch of people. I won't say who. Mm-hmm. She meets people. And I was like, oh, she's going to have to fight them all at the end. That's what's going to happen.
Superheroes?
Yeah.
Is that a spoiler?
I don't know. I think it kind of is. I don't know. But I was like, oh, she's going to have to fight them all at the end. That's going to be the climax of the movie. And then it was. And also,
I agree. And I did like to see, like, I did enjoy seeing more superheroes. And I thought those fights were fun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was more interested in sort of Bob as the dad and Helen as the hero stuff. And I think I kind of wanted to see those stories just, I don't know, resolve a little differently or something. Mm-hmm.
I just kind of wish that Bob had a little bit more to do in this. I mean, I get the metaphor and I think that's actually smart. But, you know, whenever they're cutting back and forth between the Helen stuff where she's out, like, you know, being a superhero. And then he's just like trying to teach Dash math. It's like, to me, it's like that stuff is kind of sitcom-y. And it's not as integrated into the plot. It's just they're just these little comedy moments. The best scene as far as that goes is when they go to the restaurant to confront Violet's would-be boyfriend. That actually, I think, is fun. And we get out of the house and, you know, it feels the world starts to feel a little bit more lived in than like they're in a sitcom set.
I disagree. I really liked seeing him be the dad. I felt like the first one was so much about him going out and sneaking out to have his sort of continued adventures.
Right.
I really liked seeing it from the other side. My only real complaint as far as that goes is that, I would have liked to see him sort of join the action a little sooner. And it is literally, I mean, as far as the story goes, it is basically the same as the first.
It's just a reverse. Yeah. Movie. It's a flip, which is what they did in Toy Story 2. And, you know, it's what they did in, you know, Pocahontas too. That's fine.
But
I
at the end of the day, it didn't bother me because I really liked seeing Mr. Incredible as the suburban dad.
I did too.
I really enjoyed the scenes with Jack-Jack. My problem was just sort of that the climax was a little too
pat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just sort of expecting. Exactly. And I mean, it's great action sequences and there's some really fun moments there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really fun jokes in that. Mm-hmm. I was just hoping for something a little tighter at the end. But overall. Right.
And so one of the reasons I brought up that whole thing about, like, you know, superhero movies and where we are now, when this movie came out, is like, even though you were not consciously trying to think of it in those terms, are we judging Incredibles 2, especially when it comes to things like how the reveals are set up and how the action scenes are placed and what we're doing in the A and B plot and these kinds of things? Are we viewing that from the perspective of, you know, 14 Marvel movies later?
I was literally viewing it from the perspective of I wish that they were a little more conscious of, like, the jokes, like the first one was.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, you know, there is a whole new generation of superhero movies that they could have had commentary about. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really bother me. I really was not trying to compare it to the Marvel stuff because they do have the world of the Incredibles is so, you know, uniquely the Incredibles that I'm not.
I think that this movie actually does a better job at world building and actually really kind of gives me a better idea of where we are and what they're going for.
Literally the only time Marvel would pop into my head is I would go, oh, man, they're just never going to have a Fantastic Four movie that's as good as this. And even if they did, I would be comparing it to the Incredibles at this point. Like, I just love these characters so much more than the Fantastic Four.
Right.
That I'm just like, just don't even try, like, to do that. We have it. It's here. This, you know what I mean? So that's like the only time it really popped in my head. For the most part, I was just sort of...
I wasn't thinking about it while I was watching the movie, but I did think about it after. And
honestly, I was just so happy to see these characters in action again.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of me was just thrilled to see a new adventure, if that makes sense. And I didn't think the villain was as fun, but I did think he was as cool. Really cool. So I don't know. I do think it is worth mentioning, yeah, no, I've seen a bunch of stuff online about how there isn't an epilepsy warning for this movie.
That's funny.
And I think that's actually a pretty legitimate.
Yeah. There's concern. A really cool action scene that deals with like TV screens flashing and stuff. And that's there when is, I was like, okay, they're showing off at this point. Like, they're showing off, like, oh, look what we can do.
The animation is so fucking good. But,
yeah.
But, you know, this is still a family movie. People are going to be taking young kids to see it, and young kids, especially with epileptic problems they might not know about, I can see how that's a genuine concern with parts of this movie.
Okay.
I think it gave me a because I had a really bad headache when I came out of the movie, so.
Oh, okay.
I think it did.
Did you see it in 3D?
No.
Neither did I. So what would you give this generally?
My problem is I'm comparing it so much to the first Incredibles.
I don't think that's unfair.
The first Incredibles, you know, is a plus. I would probably give this somewhere between an A minus or a B plus. Probably closer to a B plus.
Okay, I give it closer to a B minus. Personally,
all right.
And I'm grading on a curve, obviously, like, you know. I would much rather watch Incredibles 2 than, like, I don't know, some bullshit, some, like, terrible DreamWorks movie or, you know, Emoji movie like that.
Now that we've, you know, sort of talked about Pixar and sequels, this is probably my favorite Pixar sequel.
Oh, no. Toy Story 3, like, way beyond that. Probably even Toy Story 2, if I'm being honest.
I really enjoyed it. I was just so happy to, like, be back in this world. Normally I don't even see the Pixar sequels. Like, I didn't see Finding Dory. I didn't see either of the Toy Story sequels in theaters. I normally just don't even go there. I didn't see any of the Cars sequels. So just the fact that, to me, a sequel could even sort of be in conversation with the first one.
Well, this was the only one of all of the Pixar movies that I thought, like, warranted a sequel. because it's, yeah, you know, you're dealing in the world of like serialized storytelling. So it kind of makes sense. And then they waited 14 years so that they can make five Cars movies.
Yeah.
And maybe still... that lead up does, like, again, unconsciously sort of affect my viewing experience. If this came out like 2 years after the first Incredibles, maybe it'd be a different story. And again, I did not dislike this movie. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And there's a lot about it that I like. I can't believe
how much of a grump you're being about the fucking raccoon sequence, which was probably my favorite thing in the whole movie.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I
don't like movies about fucking toddlers.
I don't
like
either.
That's what it comes down to.
I don't either, but this is like superhero Mr. Mom. I liked that aspect of it. Like, that was my favorite stuff of this movie. I really enjoyed it.
And I just wish that if they were going to do that they would have given him a little bit more to do. But I like this movie. I think people should go see it. I think when people do go see it, they'll like it too. I just see on a story level how it pales in comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do agree with you there for sure. I do think it does, but I think the world and the characters and the emotion of it is there, and that sort of makes up for the story. Like, I don't know.
There's a lot to like.
Yeah. How many stories can you really tell about people trying to destroy the world?
Well, apparently endless.
Yeah. Speaking of stories of people trying to destroy the world, that's a segue.
Ham-fisted segue.
Ham-fisted. Our Netflix homework, Battlefield Earth. Why don't you break it down for us?
Oh, OG. Okay, so Battlefield Earth, we talked about a little bit at the beginning of the show, was a Dead on Arrival flop. This stars John Travolta and Barry Pepper and Forrest Whitaker. And I guess the most famous thing about it is just as sort of the country was learning that John Travolta was sort of involved in Scientology, this Church of Scientology, this movie came out, which was based on a novel by L. Ron Hubbard, the cult leader of Scientology. And when I first heard about this, I thought that, like, I don't know that much about L. Ron Hubbard, like, other than what I've seen in a few documentaries, but I always assumed that he would stopped writing fiction and around the time that Scientology started.
Man, he wrote so many fucking books.
Well, he wrote like hundreds when he was, you know, getting paid by the page and that kind of stuff in the pulp days. But I thought that after he'd started Scientology, he pretty much just became like a guru or whatever. But this book came out in 1982. So he was well into Scientology, like towards like the end of his life.
Oh, I actually didn't know he kept writing. That is interesting.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I guess those Scientology checks weren't paying all the way. But, I think this was sort of touted as a passion project for John Travolta, and I think we all got to sort of peek behind the curtain of what's going on there. But the story as it exists is, this takes place, year 3000, after the human population is almost extinct, post-apocalypse, everyone's pretty much living, you know, like a caveman. And when they see like old ruins of modern day society, they think that they were built by gods. While they're on a hunt, they are visited by, these aliens known as the Cyclos, who look a little bit like Klingons with weird breathing apparatuses attached to their nose. They try to John Travolta's character, who's like sent on a mission down to Earth to mine for gold, tries to train Barry Pepper and the other captured humans to mine the gold for him, like slaves. And to do so, he has to, like, teach him the Cyclo language and how to use Cyclo technology. And, you know, Barry Pepper and the other humans are trying to, like, overthrow them, start a mutiny. And at the same time, he's trying to, like, you know, figure out the history of what happened with the Earth and blah, 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 blah. And there's also some, I guess, inner Cyclo politics going on as well, because John Travolta is sort of revolting against his own society or doing illegal things or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
How did you watch this? Like, because I watched it alone in my room, and I felt like I was being cheated out of the correct experience for Battlefield Earth, which is to watch it with friends who are maybe a little bit more inebriated than I am, and with popcorn to throw at the screen.
For sure. I actually was watching it at work. So I agree. I wish I had been able to sort of focus on it a little bit more as a fun oddity.
Right.
Because it's not a good movie. Let's just get that out of the way. This is trash. This is really bad. It's an ugly film. It's shot very poorly. It's
super dated. I mean, it came out in 2000 and it looks like it came out in 93.
Yeah. It is a badly made movie. The script is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even sort of unpack the entire plot and like the way it's shot is insane. There's like these awful slow motion sequences that like all this stuff with the caveman people, you could tell they were definitely trying to make feel very important and heavy. And then it would like juxtapose with John Travolta being the campiest motherfucker who I swear to God, movie is so embarrassing for him.
He's chewing this up. But here's the weird thing about it, and I want to get your opinion on this. There's, like, obviously him and Forrest Whitaker, and I don't think they don't entirely know what movie they're in. I think, yes, he's, like, into L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology or whatever, so there's probably some amount of respect to the artistry of whatever the fuck. But I also think that he knows this is ridiculous because he's leaning into the bad dialogue. He's leaning into this weird character he put together. It's very jokey. There is like literal like,
but like here, so here's the
punchlines in the dialogue, and
Forrest Whitaker. Yes, I think he's like, okay, this is just some science fiction bullshit.
Yeah, this is a paycheck.
I think John Travolta is taking this so seriously.
I'm not so sure, I mean, it is
so embarrassing to watch because I feel like he thinks he is like being this villain for the fucking ages. He is so sincere, and that's what makes this movie so
fun. Character himself is goofy, and I don't think it's entirely unintentionally goofy.
I think it is.
Like, he's doing this weird accent. Like, he definitely put a lot of work into the character.
Oh yeah, he talks in like this weird like half like
transcontinental,
like,
accent.
He says is sort of exclamation points. It's really weird. It's almost like he's doing like his version of Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror Picture
Show. A little bit, yeah. Like, it is a really campy performance.
It is the queeniest, like the most drag queen, not drag queen I've ever seen. Like, it's so campy.
It's a drag performance for sure.
Yeah. And honestly, it'd be actually really fun to do as like a drag performance. But okay, so here's the thing. Here's the thing with this movie. The stuff with the cavemen is all really, I think, boring and convoluted and just sort of bad action movie stuff.
Yeah.
I am enthralled every time John Travolta is on the screen. I am like, I know what you're going to say, but how are you going to say it like the weirdo you are? Like, because he just says the same thing over and over again about having leverage over people.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird lingo in this movie, which kind of goes back to the Scientology thing of like all the weird lingo.
Like cyclos and what do they call them? Man animals.
This movie is basically like, if we want to get down to it, this is basically just like a huge ripoff of the first Planet of the Apes.
Yeah,
I mean, this is.
I don't care about any of that. Yeah. Like I said, it's trash. This is such, it is obviously pulp written to get a paycheck that, you know, probably the Scientologists upheld and took very seriously.
I don't know if they probably
that's
did.
What we're seeing. We're seeing the result of people taking something very seriously.
I think Barry Pepper is definitely taking it seriously. I think he thinks he's going to be like, this is going to turn him to the next Will Smith.
Do you think Barry Pepper was cast because he kind of looks like a more handsome version of David Miscavige?
No, I don't think so. I thought you were going to say Matthew McConaughey, because I always used to get them mixed up back when they were both young.
No, there's the other guy I'd mix up with, Matthew McConaughey. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. Now here's the thing though. This movie is, it doesn't feel like a real movie. This to me feels like the movie that would be in a movie that they were making fun of. Like this to me is like, this is like Chubby Rain from Bowfinger. Like we're watching, like they went through the trouble of actually making the entire fake movie within the movie.
Yeah, this is one of Ben Stiller's fake movies from, Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, just writ large.
Yes, no, 100%. This is the movie people are making fun of.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I wonder if it was funded by Scientologists. Like I know John Travolta was a producer.
Yeah, it's a pretty big budget. It was it's budgeted at in $2,000, $67 million, which, but you know, you can jump up inflation and then of course add the cost for marketing, which doubles that or triples it.
But it feels so cheap.
Yes, and it's also, there's a lot of like unflattering 90s-isms, and you talked ugly it is. Like every shot is at a Dutch angle. Every shot has filtered lighting. Every shot has like bad like slow-mo. There's these like really choppy looking scene wipes, transitions.
The fucking laser guns at the beginning.
Really bad green screen, like jokeable.
Yeah, green screen. And I mean, this came out after The Matrix. After The Matrix, mm-hmm. there's no excuse.
No,
and so that's what I mean. Like if you, I don't know, I've seen a few documentaries on Scientology because I think it's fascinating. That it's continued to exist and be treated like a legitimate thing for so long, even though it's an obvious con.
Right.
And you know, just by even talking about this, we're probably going to be labeled we're going to be labeled suppressive persons and whatever.
I'll wear it.
Sure. But like if you watch those documentaries and stuff, they'll show like footage of Scientology videos because they have like their own production teams. They have
a media department
studio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it all looks like really cheap and shitty like this. So that's why to me it feels like a Scientology thing. And maybe that's just me reading into sort of the backstory a little too much. But it feels like it's.
I would imagine that there was an effort by the organization to use this as a way to get people into it. Like, I don't know necessarily that the entire apparatus of the production behind it was funded by the church and that it was
maybe an arm of the church.
But I'm sure they were definitely hoping that it would bring people in the same way, like, I don't know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe brought people into Christianity.
Oh, I'm sure. But it feels like it's people who don't know what to do with a budget, if that makes sense. It feels like it's amateurs who sort of graduated to having a real, you know, movie money.
The director, Roger Christian, He'd made a few movies before this, nothing of this size. And then he was also second unit on a few of the Star Wars movies in Indiana Jones.
Okay. That kind of makes sense, actually. Because I was thinking, like, the big jet fighter, which they never explained how they got jets, did they?
They found them. And then there's flight simulators, so they learned how to fly jets really fast.
But I thought they learned how to fly the Cyclo ships.
No, they found human flight simulators, too, around the same cave that they also found the warships. So that would be like 1,000 years old by the time they found them.
That is one thing that I found, like, the logic of this movie is boggling.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Impenetrable. And I do think this movie's a little overly long for the campy schlock it is. Like, I could have used this
It's right on the at, line. It's right on the line.
I could have used it.
Again, I think if you're watching it, yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely anything over 90 minutes for something this bad is really, unless you're showgirls, like, be really careful. But
yeah, I think even with a group, like, before the big action sequence, after sort of the sequence where John Travolta
is in jail or whatever.
Like, after sort of the part where they turn on him, uh-huh, and like they almost kill him, and then he is like, I still have control of you for some reason. And then like once he drops them off at the gold mine, and right, they have the guy was like, Barry Pepper was laying out this plot of like, okay, first we have to break into Fort Knox. I was like, okay, no, I don't have the fucking time for breaking into Fort Knox.
Right.
Let's move along. So all of that stuff, yeah, I found very boring and not sort of the bad fun. I was just like, this is bad.
It's just clunky plot stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. But all the stuff with the Cyclos, I was like, holy shit, this is campy sci-fi drag queen Game of Thrones wannabe bullshit. Like, it was trying to be all political and smart.
Yeah.
And it's just the dumbest shit ever.
I'm not even sure like what the entire critique is. I mean, they're like these hyper capitalist kind of things, and I don't know. I stopped trying to sort of follow any kind of theme for a while. Although I did find one thing interesting, sort of some metatextual subtext going on. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole thing with John Travolta in the church right now, in the Church of Scientology, where he would have left after learning about some of the abuses, but he can't because they hold all this stuff over him, all this leverage because of all of the confessionals
exactly
that they do.
His character
they tape when you're in Scientology. They tape everything you say when you're doing the e-readers and all of that stuff. So that later, if you're famous or whatever, and you want to like squawk on Scientology, they say, "Oh yeah, well we're gonna tell everyone you're getting handy J's on the spa, even though everyone already knows that." And
that's true.
That kind of happens to this character in this movie. So I found that interesting on a metatextual level, but certainly not like enough to save it as a movie.
No, I also thought it was funny to me. I mean, because the rumor is that John Travolta won't leave the church because a big part of it is that he's like closeted gay or bisexual and like,
or whatever's going on. Yeah. Allegedly. It's just a rumor, but a pretty well-supported one.
Sure, and I don't care either way. If it is true, I think it's very sad that he can't be honest with that. But
yeah,
I think it is kind of interesting if you watch John Travolta movies, especially during this period of like late 80s, early 2000s, when his...
I mean late 90s.
Late 90s, early 2000s, when his sort of Tarantino heat was cooling down.
Yeah.
He had a tendency to play these sort of overly masculinized villains, which I think is really interesting. Like, this character is being punished for sleeping with like the main guy's daughter or something. And it's a very specific, weird detail.
Yeah.
And then he like has this chick with the really long, gross tongue that is literally only in one scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that's sort of an interesting through line with John Travolta's career.
Oh, for sure.
Like I said, I loved the hell out of his character and whatever he was doing. And mm-hmm. calling
with
it,
his
it
weird Muppet hands.
Oh my God, the Muppet hands. And yeah, so I enjoyed it on that level. I could use like a supercut of mostly him.
Yeah, you like, know, if they did one of those kind of like Wicker Man remake cuts of this movie, that's good enough.
So that's, I mean, this movie's trash, but I think it would be fun to watch with a group of people.
Yeah, if the New Beverly or something like that wanted to do like a cult screening of it and people were quoting lines and throwing stuff at the screen and it got rowdy.
Does that happen with this movie?
I don't know. That's the thing. It's like, it's infamous. Everyone knows about it. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen it, but I don't know if it really has that kind of like dedicated, ironic audience.
Maybe because of the Scientology baggage.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Is it's like you can only have so much fun because you know that there's like a lot of fucked up shit. But yeah,
it's literally a cult movie. So maybe that. But fuck it. It's been 18 years since this came out. I say, let's do it. Let's revive Battlefield Earth. Let's have those cult screenings where we wear weird six-fingered Muppet gloves and strange goggles
and Klingon
nose bridges.
Yeah, Klingon
with hoses.
Hair. Yeah.
Oh, the character design is so bad in this movie.
Yeah. The whole movie is just a hodgepodge of other, like, it's like they went and got like used stuff from other movies and just slapped together this one. There's like this one overhead shot where they're flying over a city. It's like, that's fucking Blade Runner. Like, you just stole that set from a mock-up from Blade Runner and added a couple more ziggurats.
Yeah, I think there's a couple that are similar that look like Escape from New York, too.
Yeah.
Escape from Los Angeles.
Some of this way the scenes are shot, it's like, oh, this is obviously the end of Star Wars or on the Death Star. All this is obviously they're grabbing this from Independence Day with the jets and stuff. So the whole thing, it just feels like totally unoriginal, like a 12th grader, like writing a homework assignment that he had to finish the night before.
Yeah. It's sort of beautiful in that way. Like I really enjoyed about half of this movie. Also, like, I thought it was weird. There's just this impenetrable logic to this movie. Like, this movie knows its own rules, but it does nothing to tell you what they are. Like, there's something about gas.
It's the whole thing is like, in that weird Scientology way, the whole thing is like very inside baseball.
Yeah. And like, if you're a high enough level, like if you're the director, or if you're the screenwriter, or if you're John Travolta, you know what's going on.
Yeah, if you were a member of Scientology at the time, I'm sure there were a lot of them who saw this like the opening night or whatever, like how like Christian churches used to like rent out theaters to show the passion when it came out. I'm sure they did that with this, and they all like nudged each other in the middle, like, how can you believe they're talking about da da da? So I don't know. It is what it is. I wanted to have more fun watching it than I did, and I think it's because of the way I watched it. I there were moments where I was like, I can see the cult appeal of this. Like, this is kind of bad in the right way. And then there were times when my phone was competing for my attention pretty hard.
That's what I mean. I think it's just a little... I think this movie, if it was a tight hour and a half, I think it would be...
A different story.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's just a little too long and a little too boring in parts.
Yeah, I mean it's bad all the way around. But to enjoy it ironically, even those are the problems.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Okay, so that's Battlefield Earth. Next week, I'm gonna have us watch, or next whenever the next time you're on the podcast, I'm gonna have us watch the movie. Probably came out around the same time, or maybe just a little bit before it. 54, the movie about the Studio 54. I was always curious about it when it came out. And I know that there's like a longer director's cut that's out there now. Unfortunately, the Netflix version is the original theatrical cut, which I think is about 14 minutes shorter. And a lot of people have said that like the director's cut makes a big difference. I don't know. But we're going to take a peep at that. And if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about on this podcast, Pixar movies, drunk cult screening with your friends of Battlefield Earth, or what are your favorite movies to watch ironically? Yeah. Email us.
Tell us all about it.
JabberTheDrone@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/JabberPodcast. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at JabberPodcast. And you can stream us over at our regular archives, jabberandthedrone.podbean.com, or at Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can read my reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com.
Follow me on Twitter, even though I don't know how much longer I'm going to have it, because I just fucking can't. Or if you do follow me on Twitter, let's engage. Let's engage. Let's be fucking human beings. And I don't know. I don't know if that app's worth trying to reclaim. But my username is Keith Foster, at Keith Foster Kid. I'm on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. It's less of an abysmal waste. Find me on Facebook. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. Check out my show that I have twice monthly at Old Town Improv Company called Book Club. This month, the month of July for Comic-Con, we are doing superhero comic books. So this is sort of a first for Book Club. It should be a lot of fun. Come check it out. Our next show will be on Saturday, July 7th, I think. This Friday, if this podcast comes out in time and you're listening to it, I'm going back to my hometown of Pocatello, and I'm going to be playing with the Comedy Project this Friday at 8 o'clock. So come check that out. That'd be fun. If you're
for sure,
hello.
Be sure to listen to our friends out there who also make podcasts of their own, including Rod and Denise over at the Listening Party, or Rod and Guest, as it were, and also Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics, Mike Fallick over at Let's Start a Cult /Hackthought. I think they're still searchable under both. Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. I think both of them are in California again, so maybe I'll get them on the podcast at some point. We can talk about theme park rides. They are pass holders as well. Check out Bill and Brian
Pixar,
over at...
Pixar Piers coming up, so...
Oh, yeah, and the Star Wars thing, right?
Well, that's not until next year, but Pixar PR opens this year.
Okay. All right. Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. And I know you have some out there too, right?
Check out Adam Connie at the Adamant podcast. Check out Meryl and Bo at Campfire Shit Show.
All right. And that'll be it.
Man animals can't fly.
Bye.